From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles celebrates its 40th anniversary this year while battling financial and leadership issues. Then, Aretha Franklin's 1972 gospel documentary Amazing Grace finally hits theaters. The film's producer explains why its director couldn't finish it.
At the time, there was a reticence to get involved. He never told me what the problem was, and that was the issue, which was that they couldn't sync the footage with the audio.
And the Los Angeles Poverty Department creates theater with the residents of LA's Skid Row. All that coming up on The Frame. The Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles is celebrating 40 years of music and activism with a string of special performances to mark the anniversary. That's a song from the chorus's album titled I Rise. But some dark clouds linger over the festivities after allegations of sexual harassment by one-time board chairman John Duran came to light earlier this year. Duran denies the allegations and remains on the chorus board, though no longer in an official leadership role. Duran is also a city councilman in West Hollywood. Three fellow council members there have called for his resignation following the allegations. And the chorus is also grappling with a sizable budget shortfall that led the board to consider dissolving the organization. But earlier today, interim executive director Lou Spisto told me leadership is determined to maintain the chorus's activist and artistic presence in Los Angeles, starting with their 40th anniversary spring performance. And he says the show is about more than just music.
Throughout the concert, members of the chorus step out and talk a bit about who we were and how we've evolved over these past 40 years. You know, when the chorus was founded in 1979 at Plummer Park, there were guys, whenever we would have a publicity shoot or a photo or any kind of video of the chorus, there were men who would have to step aside and not be photographed. We were in that world. You know, we take for granted what it means to be a gay men's chorus in L.A. and America.
I would imagine the AIDS virus really impacted or changed the overall mission of the chorus, because if I understand right, in the early days, it was about being this place where men could go and feel part of a community and be out, but at the same time, they had to be careful. But when the AIDS virus hit, can you talk a little bit about what the chorus came to represent for these men and the community?
The chorus came to represent a fight for our lives. We've all lost people. If you're of a certain age in this community, and many of our members are of that age and older. I mean, the great thing about the chorus is today we have guys that are 20 years old and guys that are 85 years old in the chorus. And, you know, the chorus never set out to be particularly an activist organization. The chorus set out to be a place to be and a place to sing. And they wound up singing and speaking and shouting and raising voices in a way that was far more than what was able to be done on stage. So the Gay Men's Chorus of LA became that activist group because we had to fight for our lives. So that's what it became. And it also became a place of solace. The chorus in the 80s became almost the group that would sing at funerals and memorials and sing at AIDS fundraisers, and it really became, in effect, a chorus that spoke for that time and that movement. It was a very tough time, and there were over 150 men lost over that period between the 80s and the 90s, 150 men in the chorus. So the chorus really played what role it could. I mean, we are social activists, we are singers, but the role of the chorus was to be part of the community and do what it could and what it can and what it will, and that's to sing, to raise our voices, to raise the collective voice. So GMCLA became very, very well known in the community for much more than simply giving wonderful concerts, but the wonderful concerts and the music is always the core.
Earlier this year, the president of the chorus's board, John Duran, faced accusations of sexual harassment involving at least three chorus members.
Right.
What has the organization done, and what does it still need to do to resolve the fallout from these allegations?
Well, the organization always had a very clear sexual harassment and workplace policy. What we are doing now to reinforce what we mean and how to go forward is we are bringing in an individual recommended to us by the FCC Church. The First Congregational Church has had a wonderful person work with them, and we are working with him now to set up a full sexual harassment training program and you know, workplace behavior training program. We have to make sure that these policies are followed. These things are important. They were taken seriously, and we're going to do what we should do, what we have already done, and that's to make sure that this is a safe place for everybody.
John Duran is still a board member, correct?
He is.
If the organization is trying to correct past wrongs, why is he still on the board?
That's not my decision to make, and I can't give you the answer there. I do know that John has stated that he's stepping down off the board this summer. So that I knew when I came on.
The board actually considered dissolving the chorus. Why was such a drastic step considered? And is that still a possibility?
When you have an organization with a $2.5 million budget and your balance sheet is negative $400,000, that's a big hole to dig out from. It's going to take time. We can do this with cost-cutting measures and more aggressive fundraising and more aggressive marketing for the concerts and doing things more smartly. But we didn't close the doors. I am absolutely convinced that this concert proves ticket sales are good. They could be better. We're going to have about a two-thirds house. We have these new grants that came in. We have a fantastic show. I mean, this is the best hits of, and if we deliver what I've heard them deliver in rehearsal, people are going to be thrilled with a concert.
Lou Spisto is Interim Executive Director of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. Lou, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Turn Back Time. Best of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles is this weekend, April 6th and 7th, at the Alex Theater in Glendale. Coming up on The Frame, the never-released film chronicling Aretha Franklin's historic 1972 gospel performance in Los Angeles finally makes it to the big screen. Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace, recorded in 1972, became the biggest-selling album of her career. In fact, the biggest-selling gospel album of all time. I want the world to know that he standing at the podium of the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in South L.A., she delivered an electrifying performance. Filmmaker Sidney Pollack and a camera crew were also in the church, but the film that Pollack hoped to complete never saw the light of day. It was tied up for decades by technical and legal issues. Franklin once claimed she never even signed off on a film deal. But after the Queen of Soul's passing last year, the Franklin estate reached an agreement with producer Alan Elliott. The Frame's John Horn spoke with Elliott about the film's epic saga. It started with a conversation Elliott had with record producer Jerry Wexler, one of the original producers of Amazing Grace.
Jerry Wexler became somebody that I sought out, and at a certain point, he said to me, "Yeah, we filmed Amazing Grace." And he said, "That was Sidney Lumet."
He didn't even have the right Sidney.
No.
And it was Sidney Pollack, of course.
And, you know, in corporate speak, he said to me, because I said to him, I said, "So what happened?" And he said, "I made a great record." And that was his way of saying, "I didn't screw up, the film company did."
I want to hear about your first contact with Sidney Pollack and the footage, what you knew about it, and what you found out might have been missing.
My first exposure to Sidney Pollack was in 1990, and at the time, there was a reticence to get involved.
On his part.
There was just sort of, it's a good idea. And this continued, you know, this is 1990. It stops for me until then I pick it up in 2007.
This is 35 years after the concert, right?
This is 36 years after the concert. At that point, he was more interested and more dedicated to it. He never told me what the problem was. And that was the issue, which was that they couldn't sync the footage with the audio.
And was it as simple as they didn't slate it? They didn't have a clapper in front of the cameras, or the audio record? It was just that they could not sync things.
Yeah. When you see the movie, which you've seen, you know, there are these hilarious cameramen who are dressed in flowing satin robes in multicolors. You know, they're not what you would think of as film crew in the modern day and age, where you have guys wearing black and they're very, you know, inconspicuous. These people are in every shot. And when you look at it and you see that there's no slates, you go, well, okay, how is anybody planning to sync this up? And evidently nobody had a plan.
When you start trying to put the footage together, you purchase it in 2007, is that right?
Yes.
So what were the obstacles? You have this footage, you have these audio recordings. How do you end up matching them together?
Complete luck. There is a woman named Beverly Wood, who used to be one of the heads of Deluxe Film Laboratories. And I was at a party, and at a certain point she said, what are you working on? And I said, Amazing Grace. And she said, what is that? And I said, it's Aretha Franklin. And she said, what? And I said, yeah, there's a film of it that Sidney Pollack made, but I'm having this issue. And she said, we might be able to help with that. And by the end of the conversation, she said, on Monday, I'm going to send a truck over to your house to pick up all the elements. And then let's find out if we can fix it. And 3 weeks later, she said, you should come into the editing facility over in Burbank. And I did, and I saw all the footage sunk together.
They had matched it all up.
And they had matched it up. There's a
Something Sidney Pollack couldn't do in decades, they did in 3 weeks.
There's a fellow named Serge Perrin, who works over at Deluxe, and his main job is to match audio with video. And he's a genius.
So you have the footage, you have it synced, you edit it together, you go to the 2015 Telluride Film Festival, you're about to show the film, and some lawyers for Aretha Franklin say, not quite yet. What was the dispute?
She has a niece who's now the executor of the estate. And Sabrina Owens came to me about 3 or 4 months after this, because the movie got sold to Lionsgate in 2015. And then Aretha didn't want to sign the contract, and we couldn't figure out why. And Sabrina came to me and said she's got pancreatic cancer, and that I had made this eulogy to Aretha Franklin. I didn't know at the time she had pancreatic cancer. I don't know if you want to see your life pass before your eyes, literally, and then have to go out and do press on it, and then have to go and do all that and have pancreatic cancer. And so we just agreed that we wouldn't have this conversation for a while. You know, I didn't start the process to have Aretha Franklin mad at me.
We're talking with Alan Elliott about the documentary Amazing Grace. Let's talk about the quality of performance over these two incredibly hot days, because it looks like everybody is sweating buckets.
Yeah.
What was, to you, most visible in the performance that really captured her talent?
The record was just this incredible masterpiece. And what we see in the movie is an interesting duality, because we have Aretha performing in a church with her father there. So there's an expectation of an incredible church service, but there's also the professional thing of making a recording of sacred music. The first time we really get it in the movie is they do What a Friend We Have in Jesus. And she does the first verse, and she likes it. But then right before they're going to go into the second verse, she looks at James Cleveland and says, let's do that one more time. Oh, what a friend. And they do the first verse again. And they're making a record. You know, that's different than...
You don't see that a lot of concerts.
Right, you don't see that in a concert. You don't see that in church. So she's singularly focused in this dual way of having to deliver for the choir, for the band, for the audience, and she's a perfectionist as a record maker, and they're making records. What a privilege. Yeah, it is okay.
There are some interesting people at the show, including Mick Jagger, I think Charlie Watts, they're in town, and also one of Aretha Franklin's idols, Clara Ward. And she composed a gospel classic and a song off the album called How I Got Over.
How I got over, how I got over. You know my soul looks back and wonder how I got over, how I got over.
It's important to note that this album was hugely successful, especially when you consider that it's largely gospel music, that it was a landmark recording on so many different levels and is still, I think, considered one of the great live performances and gospel performances of all time.
You know, this was Aretha Franklin at the height of being Aretha Franklin. She has 13 number one R&B hits in a row. She's now getting to a level where she's not so worried about making a hit record. She is now going to make an artistic statement. And that artistic statement comes from her home and what she wants to do, which is to go and make a gospel record. And she's competitive because there are hit records that are in the gospel field at that point. The Hawkins family had Oh Happy Day. Melanie had Lay Down. And, you know, George Harrison had My Sweet Lord. There are huge gospel influences, and Aretha Franklin is there to tell you that that's hers to take home. So this is really an artistic statement for her on a different level and maybe a more mature level than let's go find a hit single and suss out the rest of the record.
How did her death change the trajectory of this documentary?
Well, it was an unsaid, you know, for the last couple of years, because when Sabrina told me that she was sick, we had this understanding we weren't going to deal with the movie until after she passed. And I understood it because the last song, the spoiler alert is the last song in the movie is the first song she ever recorded, which is Never Grow Old. And have to deal with that mortality check is a you know, something I wasn't interested in putting her through, and because that's, you know, the respectful thing to do.
So after Aretha dies, you have contact with her estate, and last year you played the film for several dozen members of her family at the Charles Wright African American Museum in Detroit, which seems to be the catalyst for why we're talking today. What happens in that screening, and how does it get us to where we are?
So my producing team, my friend Terrell Whitley and Rob Johnson, were invited to go to the funeral by Sabrina. And so we went to the funeral in late August. We never talked business. We just went there and showed our respect. And a couple weeks later, Sabrina said, would you come and show the movie to the family? So we did. And Sabrina called me on the way home and said, we want to do it. And I said, great, let's go do it.
We'll never.
Alan Elliott, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, John. It's good to see you. Never go.
Amazing Grace opens in select theaters this weekend in Los Angeles and New York, followed by a national rollout in the weeks ahead. Coming up on The Frame, the LAPD creates theater on Skid Row. But it's not the LAPD you think. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas sitting in for John Horn. Most people know LAPD as an acronym for the Los Angeles Police Department, but it also stands for the Los Angeles Poverty Department, an award-winning arts and theater group formed on LA's Skid Row in 1985. The company's aim is to tell stories for, with, and about homeless people. The troupe is about to premiere its latest production called I Fly, or How to Keep the Devil Down in the Hole. It was created after a beloved member of the Skid Row community was shot and killed by an LA police officer in 2015. The Frame contributor, Marcos Najera, has the story.
The people who live and work in LA Skid Row have lots of stories to tell.
Miss Stephanie?
I'm Stephanie.
Nice to meet you, Miss Stephanie. I'm Marcos.
We were just... You too, baby.
Stephanie Bell joined the Los Angeles Poverty Department just to make sure her stories are heard.
I've been for 24 years out of everybody in here. And I have been through all sorts of shows.
Bell loves to sing out about the joys and pains she's felt during the nearly three decades of living with this community. She says LAPD shows even help her remember those friends that she's lost along the way.
Matter of fact, I'll be speaking upon one of them in my play, Kevin Michael Key. That was my heart. He helped a lot of people down here in the community, plus me once upon a time. And then he passed away 2 years ago. He had cancer. Do you understand? I met that man 3 years ago, 2015.
That was 4 years ago.
Whatever. And I'm not playing with you.
And, you know, one thing, I mean, I've been working here for, you know, 3.5 decades, but...
John Malpede is the founding artistic director of the Los Angeles Poverty Department, a first-of-its-kind troupe mainly made up of people from all over America who wound up living on L.A. city streets. He formed LAPD to collaborate with the residents of Skid Row, and their goal is to use theater, music, and spoken word as tools to confront the urgent issues of this community.
One thing that was clear from the very beginning was that because there is a much wider range of experience among people here than in maybe most places, that means that many people here have a wisdom and know how to deal with a wider range of experience.
And there's going to be this chalk outline of his body, and people write, "Rest in peace, Brother Africa."
Henriette Brower is his Malpede's wife and co-director of their latest show. It's called I Fly, or How to Keep the Devil Down in the Hole.
When we all gather around
the body,
yeah, you don't have to play that you are sad. Just feel it.
Inside a large room at Skid Row's Church of the Nazarene, Browers and Malpede rehearse with the troupe. It's a devised piece of theater. They began with writing workshops and acting exercises first, and then wrote the script based on their discoveries.
And now they say we've got them surrounded, and we haven't even moved.
If you walk with Jesus.
Soon, drummers from the Skid Row Players and a funk soul band added sound.
You got to keep the devil way down in the hole.
Outside the rehearsal hall, a half-opened fire hydrant is leaking. Someone has put down a bucket filled with dishes and clothes to capture the drops. Around that hydrant are endless rows of tents filled with folks going about their business. A few years ago, the troupe was rehearsing a show when they heard gunshots coming from this tent city. They ran outside only to learn that police had shot and killed a community member known as Brother Africa.
We were just in shock.
Walter Fears remembers that day well. He's a core member of LAPD.
People were crying. People were upset. We couldn't rehearse anymore that day.
But what they could do was turn their anger and sadness into this new show.
What to do beyond giving up? What to do beyond protest?
The show explores issues of public safety. And it asks the question, what can residents do alongside law enforcement to keep people safe?
I'm telling y'all, we got some amazing acts coming from this community today, and you're going to love it.
The play is set at the Festival for All Skid Row Artists. That's an actual annual event at which performers from Skid Row share their work with the public. This October will mark the 10th anniversary. And while it's taken years to establish art as a regular presence in the community, Walter Fears fondly remembers those early days when John Malpede and Henriette Browers would hold public meetings to raise support.
And then they were here doing this symposium, and there was all these white people in there talking about black people, and I'm like, what?
How y'all gonna talk about black people? There ain't no black people in here. You know what I'm saying? So that's where I was coming from. They came up to me and they said, well, why don't you come to our space? And I've been with them ever since.
When Fears joined LAPD, he says he had found himself living on the streets after graduating from college, joining the military, and teaching in Orange County. A swimming pool accident left him unable to work while recovering in a hospital for many months. Eventually, symptoms of PTSD stemming from his military service slowly crept up. Soon, he says he became addicted to meds, and he was unable to complete his treatment.
The insurance company dropped me. The hospital kicked me out. That's how I ended up on Skid Row.
You gotta keep the devil way down in the hole.
It was horrible. My first night, it was a little scary because I had no idea the first thing about being homeless. I ended up meeting a guy who was a veteran. He showed me how to dumpster dive, you know, go get cardboard, how to tie it off to where the rats won't get in. So that's the nature of Skid Row. People look out for each other here. Working man, not only that, a veteran. There should have been a support system to catch me.
Fears now has a new wife and a place to live, but he keeps coming back to work with LAPD and his friends in this neighborhood because he says there's still lots of work to be done.
It was the best thing that ever happened to me because, you know, I ended up coming here and finding myself.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Los Angeles Poverty Department show, I Fly, or How to Keep the Devil Down in the Hole, will be performed April 4th through 6th at the Disney Concert Hall's Red Cat Theater. And that's The Frame for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.